And, but the petabytes of data that would be coming in, every detail of every scanner reading from more than 36 ships, defied examination by any human mind, master or not. If he had to watch 40 ships sacrificed to the enemy, he intended at least to come away with usable data, every detail of what worked and what didn't. He'd been sent there simply to determine if what had been informally dubbed the Avia method actually worked. But he wanted more. If the scanner program did allow effective targeting of the enemy, he wanted more than confirmation. He wanted every detail that could allow the system to be refined, improved. The lead ships of the verification force are closing into projected enemy fire range. Ilya sighed softly, doing all he could to keep it to himself. This was the moment, the 10 or 20 minutes that would determine the mission's success or failure. If Krellos' ships were blasted to atoms before they reached their own firing ranges, all his warriors would die for nothing. Ilias and the crews of his monitoring ships would transit and run back to Calphron, defeated and empty-handed. But if the evasion routines worked well enough, if Krellos had some of the old magic left in that ancient mind and body, maybe, just maybe, Ilias would return with word that Killeron Tragus's firing solutions worked, that the next time a hegemony fleet met the others in battle, the fight would be at least a bit more even. All ships continue forward. Krellos sat in Hataria's command chair, his eyes still bright, attentive, despite his advanced age. His flagship was almost as old as he was, as were most of the vessels in his cobbled-together force. The deployment of the fleet's oldest and most obsolete ships to the desperately dangerous expedition, Krellos felt he owed it to his crews not to call it a suicide mission, had been his suggestion. It had required some crash retrofitting to bring the scanning suites up to snuff, and upgrades of the weapons arrays to allow the small force to truly test out their new targeting algorithms, but it preserved the most battle-worthy vessels for the fight Krellos knew was coming, the struggle that would ultimately determine if the hegemony survived. All units acknowledged, Commander. Krellos was resolved to his likely fate, and while he longed on one level to be there when the hegemony fought the ultimate battle for the future, he had lived a long and productive life. He relished the chance to return to the colors, to serve the hegemony one last time, to die as he had lived, as a master and a protector of humanity. His greatest regret was that most of those who would die with him were far younger than he was, that many would lose long and productive decades that otherwise would have lain before them. The loss of so many useful lives would be a tragedy, though one that seemed insignificant compared to the magnitude of all that was at stake. Commander, we're picking up energy readings from the enemy formation. AI analysis suggests weapon systems being activated. Krellos remained still, though he could feel his hand shaking. It wasn't fear, just the tremors he always endured, the result of the nerve damage spreading through his aged and failing body. He was old, even by the standards of humanity's genetic elite, but he had not escaped all of time's ravages. All ships engage pre-programmed evasive routines. He had done all he could to ensure his small force was prepared to complete its mission, whatever the cost. The enemy's weapons outranged his own, and that meant his fleet would have to endure and survive incoming fire while it continued to close. When, if, his ships reached their own firing range, they could complete their mission, determine with some level of certainty whether or not the radiation detection routine enabled effective targeting of enemy vessels. If the algorithm worked, if his people were able to score a certain number of verified hits, 10 was the number in his mind, he could give the retreat order. And every ship in his small command would be free to make a run for it, to try to escape, however unlikely such a result might be. His eyes were fixed on the display. The massive 3D setup was another new addition to Hataria's otherwise simple and dingy bridge. There were tiny flashes, a few at first, and then dozens as the lead formations of the enemy fleet opened fire. His ships were already into their defensive routines, and Krellos nodded silently, an expression of gratitude that whatever technological advantages the others possessed, they did not appear to include the ability to negate random chaos-driven evasive maneuvers. That was no guarantee of survival for any of his vessels, a fact emphasized by the disappearance of one of his ships from the display, the first casualty of the battle. But it did offer hope, at least, that his people who died would not do so in vain. He winced as one of the flashes zipped right past Hataria, coming, he guessed, within 2 or 3 kilometers of the battleship. 1.2, he silently acknowledged as the AI streamed the data onto his screen. His recollections of space combat were many and varied, But the forces he'd led had always been superior, and death and defeat, if they came at all, had been slow, gradual. He remembered ships being damaged, battered by hit after hit, until finally, some critical system or another failed and triggered an epic explosion. Or vessels were simply pummeled into lifeless hulks. But he knew well from reviewing the data from Venta Draconis that the enemy's main guns could cripple a hegemony battleship with a single shot, and even destroy one outright. It was a different feeling, one harder to control as he looked into the display, knowing any second could be his last, that he and his flagship's crew, so far untouched by the enemy's fire, might die at any moment without the slightest warning. He watched as three more of his ships were hit, two suffering severe damage, and the third vanishing in an instant of thermonuclear fury. He'd known when he volunteered that his force would suffer terribly closing to combat range, but it had been many years since he'd seen his comrades dying in such numbers, and he found it harder to endure than he'd expected. However ready he'd believed he was, he realized there were some things one could never fully prepare for. He'd prepared himself for heavy losses, even to die himself. But now he began to imagine a total failure, the loss of all his ships before they closed enough to test their new target locks. He opened his mouth, as if to give a command, but he remained silent. He'd been about to order his ships to alter their evasion routines, but he realized that would be a waste of time at best, and harmful at worst. The programs had been devised in as random a pattern as possible. The losses he'd suffered so far were the result of the others targeting prowess and high-tech scanners, not any failure of the routines. If he ordered his commanders to take control themselves, to engage in their own programs, the loss rate would almost certainly spike. Krellis was a veteran of more than two-thirds of a century of service, a hardened warrior who had faced countless dangers. But even he felt overwhelmed, held almost in awe by the mysterious ships moving steadily toward his fleet, the eerie blue beams of their weapons slicing through space, and when one connected inflicting catastrophic damage on the ships he commanded. His eyes darted to his screen, to the range display. 50,000 kilometers until his lead ships could open fire. The range would still be long, and shots fired from such a distance would provide weak and confusing data regarding the efficacy of the firelocks. He knew he had to get at least some of his ships in close, near enough to overcome the enemy's own evasion tactics, and determine with some sense of certainty whether the new scanner programs truly worked. His mind ran calculations, evaluating the losses to date, and extrapolating those he was likely to suffer the rest of the way in. The enemy's hit rates would climb as the distance diminished, though how much was probably more guesswork than calculation. He decided to call it an estimate, and he finished his analysis. Some of his ships would get close enough, assuming the enemy hit rates didn't soar as the range dropped. He tried to cut off the line of thought before it moved to the inevitable next calculation. A projection on how many of his ships might survive long enough to make escape attempts, and how many had even a remote chance of making it back to the tube. The effort failed. He didn't have an exact analysis, but he didn't need one to know that none of his people, not one, was going to make it out of Upsilon Vega. Perhaps our deaths can continue to serve. No doubt Ilias would record everything happening in the system. The enemy targeting data, their accuracy percentages at different ranges, to median damage caused by hits at various distances. It was all useful tactical data, a bit more coin perhaps paid in return for the lives of 18,000 Kriegeri and 9 Masters. And one very old fleet commander, perhaps just a bit less useful than people had thought. Megaron Krellis' ships are opening fire, Commander. Ilias's crew was disciplined and focused, as were most Kriegeri forces, and all of those who served under the veteran Megaron's command. But discipline and experience proved inadequate to hide the tension and excitement in the officer's voice. Ilias might have scolded the Hectoron, but he knew the Kriegeri was as aware as he was, as every officer and rank-and-file warrior in the small armada was, that the next moments would reveal whether the hegemony fleet had a chance in the war, or at least the ability to hurt the enemy, to make them pay for their gains. There were reasonable standards, even ones that were very tough and strict. And then there was expecting human beings to behave as machines. Besides, Ilias was far from sure his own tone and demeanor were hiding the anxiety gnawing at him. He watched silently, his tension growing with every sudden flash on the screen. Krellis's ships were indeed firing, and they were missing. Ilias watched a dozen shots, and not one came close to any of the enemy ships, at least as far as he could tell at his own vessel's extreme range. Even as he sat there, he realized how much he'd allowed hope to penetrate his usual grim and skeptical psyche. He could feel the sense of promise slipping away, the now unwelcome hope being driven from his mind. Krellos's force had lost half its strength, but the surviving ships were still pressing on, moving forward with as much thrust as sometimes damaged engines could produce. The output and the resulting acceleration had fallen, of course, when the vessels had been compelled to divert energy to weapons arrays, but the fleet was pressing on with what Ilias realized was suicidal bravery. He'd never been one to allow emotions to slip into his assessment of war, but years of seeing the often selfless sacrifice of the Rim Warriors, the desperate determination they had displayed in the face of overwhelming odds, had shaken him from his almost robotic expectations. He understood heroism in ways he never had, and he realized he was watching it in action. Another pair of ships blinked from his screen, another 1,000 Kriegeri lost. But the rest of Krellos's fleet continued on, blasting away at their maximum rate of fire. Then he saw it. A shot from Hataria's main battery. A hit. Ilias closed his eyes for a second and then reopened them, focusing again on what he'd seen. He was about to request confirmation from the AI when 3 more shots hit enemy targets in rapid succession. The hit rate was still poor, no more than 4 or 5%. But there was no doubt the targeting was working. The chances of 4 random hits were so unimaginable as to be almost indistinguishable from 0. Ilias felt a wave of excitement, one that almost slipped past his efforts to remain calm. He'd seen an entire battle fleet, one vastly larger than Krellos's beleaguered force, fight a protracted battle without scoring a single hit, save only for Avia's one focused shot. Now a dozen remaining vessels, some of them damaged and leaving trails of instantly refreezing atmosphere and fluids behind them, had scored no less than 4 hits. 5. Ilias turned his head, looking toward the scanner contacts, the enemy ships now engaged in something far more like an actual battle. He could see their reactions, an increase in evasive maneuvers, and a few seconds later, after 2 more of Krellos's shots connected, something new. Energy readings. Radiation. One of the enemy ships was showing signs of detectable damage. Ilias's head snapped around as his bridge crew erupted in a ragged wave of shouts and applause. It was the kind of outburst he rarely tolerated. But this time, he just looked around the bridge, and he added his own acclamation to that of his people. It was a victory, small, fleeting, far from decisive, but a triumph nevertheless, a light in the darkness of defeat that had plagued his people since the others had arrived. He felt as close to unrestrained joy as he could ever remember, and he dared to imagine a route, a long and bloody one for certain, but a path nevertheless, to survival, to victory. His excitement was short-lived, however, as cold reality reasserted itself with brutal force. He was staring right at the display when the small blue symbol, the icon representing Hataria, disappeared. For an instant he tried to imagine it was a scanner error, a failure of the display mechanism. But he knew with cold certainty that the old battleship was gone, and with it, Krellos. The hegemony had lost a hero, but the old man had died as he had lived, in combat and in victory. Ilias glanced over the display one more time, confirming to himself that none of the handful of vessels remaining in Krellos's force had any chance at all of escaping. It hurt to leave them, but he knew his duty. Krellos was gone, and soon thousands of his warriors would join him. It was a dark and somber end, the mission, but it had not been in vain. Killer Ontragus's theory had been confirmed, his targeting tactics validated. Ilias's ships clustered around the tube had collected petabyte upon petabyte of detailed data, and their duty was now clear. The hegemony was still outgunned and outclassed, but at least it could fight back now. That was no guarantee of victory or even survival, but it was a chance, and that was the best Ilias could have hoped for. Hectoron, all ships are to initiate maximum thrust, all vectors toward the transit tube. We've got the data we came for, now we've got to get it back to Calphoron. Yes, Megaron. Ilias glanced one last time at Krellos's survivors, now no more than 6 battered ships bracketed by multiple enemies. It was almost over, and when the final vessel was destroyed, it would be nothing but a mercy. It was painful, and thoughts of his old commander and mentor drifted through his mind. But those spacers still fighting, out there battling through their last moments, and Krellos, who had led them there, the hero who had already passed on to legend, had at least not been sacrificed for nothing. Millions of their comrades would use the knowledge they had provided. They would fight to avenge the losses suffered in Upsilon Vega and Adventa Draconis. They would fight to save the hegemony. To save humanity. and the heroes lost there would never be forgotten, not if the hegemony endured. He leaned back as he felt this ship's engines firing, driving the vessel, along with its companions, toward the transit tube. Toward the way home. Chapter 18. Planet Kelfron. Sigma Nordlin 4. Year of Renewal 267. 322 AC. No, that is not going to happen. First, I could never convince the Confederation Senate to approve it, even if I was willing. Baron stared at Akella, his eyes cold. Which I must emphasize without doubt or reservation, I most certainly am not. Against all odds, Baron had actually warmed to his hegemony hosts. He'd been treated with courtesy and respect, and he'd come to accept them, if in a halting, irregular sort of way. Moments of respect had been interspersed with sudden memories of the war, of the terrible losses the hegemony invasion had inflicted on his warriors. His head was spinning, the confusion struggling to overtake his rational thought, to lead him one way and then abruptly to shove him off in another direction. But when Akella suggested, gently and diplomatically, that the two sides attempt to negotiate a return of Colossus to hegemony control, Baron had no doubt whatsoever how he felt. I understand your point of view, Admiral, I truly do, and no doubt I would feel the very same way were I in your shoes. Baron had been stunned at how charming Akella was, and how calm and reasoned. He'd come to see the hegemony as brutal conquerors, and while he was still far from forgiveness for all that had happened, he was beginning to see the other side. Bits and pieces, at least. Certainly the humans living coreward of the Rim had suffered vastly more in the Cataclysm, and as much as he bristled at the idea of another power conquering him for his own good, he couldn't help but understand to an extent what drove the hegemony and its leaders. Still, Akella had devoted enormous amounts of her time to private discussions with him, as well as meetings between the two of them and Kronos. He acknowledged her devotion, but it told him something more, something unintended. Akella was trying to keep him away from the rest of the council as much as possible. He believed the hegemony's number one was a true believer, that her only concerns were saving humanity from a repeat of the disasters of the past. But Baron didn't have the slightest doubt many of her colleagues, while playing lip service to such lofty ideals, were simply arrogant and defensive of their prerogatives as highly ranked masters. You would very likely feel the same way, and I wonder how you would respond to a request by your hopefully former enemies to return the very superweapon they had deployed against you. I cannot say, Tyler. I will not insult your intelligence with answers drawn from the scripts of diplomacy. What I ask not because I consider it fair, nor because I am sure I would consent myself, but rather because it is so vitally important to defeat the others. Though you may not yet fully believe me, that is as crucially important for your own people as for mine. Colossus is a great weapon, the manifestation of pre-fall imperial might. Since it was found and my people restored it to functional status, it has served as the core of our defensive forces, waiting in silent watch for the others to return. And yet you detached it from that purpose and sent it to the Rim, to fight my people. Baron had managed to check most of his resentment, but he could hear a bit of it slip out, resurgent in his words. My people are loath to admit their faults and errors, Tyler, and the Masters above all. I am no exception. The invasion of the Rim could not have occurred without my approval, so I bear the guilt for all that happened. Such action was our way, all we have known, and however many perished in the fighting, understand that orders of magnitude more would have, will, die if the Great Death returns, if we live now not in a period of recovery, as some would believe, but in a mere pause of a far longer decline. I do not make excuses, nor do I ask for pardon, but I beg you to consider that there is much your people do not know of the galaxy and its history. Can you say, for all your love of independence and your defiant courage, that you are sure your people do not face a continuation of your cataclysm? Does the Rim and its history over the past 2 centuries seem like a return to the Pax Imperia, to centuries, no, millennia, of peace and prosperity? Your Confederation, barely 100 years old, has fought, what, 4 wars with the Union? Your Palatian allies endured a century of enslavement, did they not? And they used their independence to ensure they were never again conquered, but instead subjugating their neighbors. Indeed, for all the clear camaraderie your warriors exhibited in the recent fighting, my understanding is you yourself fought a bitter conflict with a Palatian vessel. The Rim is torn with strife and plagued by almost constant war. Can you really say to me, Tyler Baron, that your people, not just of the Confederation, but all the humans on the Rim, have truly evolved out of the Dark Age that followed the Imperial fall? That you are not still in that decline, still sinking into barbarism and despair? Akella's words had barren like a club. She'd started by admitting her own people's faults, and that had disarmed him, tamped down on his angry response. He felt the urge to answer her questions, to state with unwavering certainty that the Rim was indeed rising from the darkness and not descending back into it. But her arguments were cutting, and he had no replies, none that didn't leave him full of doubts. He was the grandson of the Confederation's great hero, an officer who had cut his teeth in one war, led his forces to victory in another desperate conflict, and lived to die in a third one. His father had been lost in battle as well, and his own career, as he looked back on it, seemed like nothing so much as a continuation of that trend. He could resent the hegemony, rage against Akella for allowing her forces to invade his home, but he couldn't question her intelligence. And now that he'd spent time with her, he couldn't portray her any longer as a murderous monster bent on conquest. Things were indeed far more complex than he might have imagined, and whatever he felt about the hegemony as an enemy, he had no difficulty imagining even worse adversaries out there. He retched at the idea of sending Confederation warriors to fight and die to save hegemony worlds, but the cold shadow standing behind him whispered the same question to him again and again. If Akella's people are destroyed, what will happen to the Rim? It is too much, Akella. I can believe much of what you say, and yet the most recent enemy, and the one who inflicted the worst damage on my people, is still the hegemony. We can talk of the cataclysm, of civilization rising and falling, of terrifying enemies approaching, but the only incontrovertible fact I can draw upon is that little more than 1 year ago, your people were killing mine. Baron's words held a firmer line than his thoughts. He'd seen footage of the force Akella called the Others, and while he was well aware such things could be doctored and manufactured outright, his blood had still run cold while he'd watched. He couldn't prove any of it was accurate, but he believed it was, and that made the walls close in on him. He couldn't imagine sending the massed Confederation fleets past the Badlands to hegemony space to fight alongside their recent enemies. But the idea of simply waiting, of the Confederation leadership burying their heads in the sand while this new enemy crushed the hegemony, and then came for the Rim, was no less unthinkable. I can apologize for the invasion if you wish, Tyler, though I would not wish to do so, as you are an intelligent man and you would know it was not entirely sincere. I am sorry so many were killed, that so much suffering resulted, and I obviously regret the destruction of so much combat power on what turned out to be the eve of the Others' return. But I will not disrespect you by claiming I do not believe your people would be better off as part of the hegemony, that I am not convinced we all face an inexorable decline into a dark age thousands of years long if we cannot find a way to avoid the mistakes of the past. I do not wish ill to your people, Tyler Baron. Quite the contrary, though this may seem a difficult thing to comprehend from your point of view, as one who fought my warriors, as one who lost friends in the war. Baron was struck again by Akella's apparent reason and her calm assessments. Again, he didn't agree with everything she said. But he wasn't sure he quite disagreed either. Does it really matter? Even if she convinces you, can you get the Senate to consent to send the bulk of the fleet to hegemony space? Very well, Akella, you have convinced me of one thing. We must put bad feelings from the war aside and the vast differences in our cultures and beliefs. Whatever happens with the Others, as you call them, I would strive for a future of peace between our peoples. Yet the hegemony's basic directive gives you no choice, does it? If my people, if all the Rim, were to join in your fight, help you defeat the Others, what guarantee do we have that you would not immediately renew your efforts to subjugate us? Your initial reasons would remain the crusade that has defined the hegemony since its founding. I have no desire to become one of your Kriegery warriors, Akella, and I believe I can speak for all of my comrades in that regard. There is no question in my mind, Tyler, no discernible doubt that you would achieve master status if you submitted to the test. Indeed, the Rim suffered far less than your own worlds in terms of genetic degradation during the Great Death. Many of your people would place very highly. It is possible even that a new number one would emerge from one of your worlds. If that happened, you would see that I am no hypocrite when I stepped aside and turned the hegemony over to a Rim dweller. She paused. Excuse me for that tangent. To answer your question more directly, you would have my word, Tyler Baron. If your people aid us, there will be no renewed invasion of the Rim. The hegemony will abandon its core directive with regard to the Rim. We will seek to remain allies with your people, not to absorb them into the hegemony. Baron almost scowled, but he didn't. It seemed absurd that he would believe the leader of his recent bitter enemies. But he realized he did believe her. Still, he knew it wasn't enough. I do not question your integrity, Akella. Yet what assurance is there in your word? You can be replaced any year, any time the test reveals one of your people with a higher rating than yours. And of course, there are myriad other ways power could change hands. You may feel the hegemony is above such things as coups and civil wars, but I cannot afford to make so casual an assumption. You are still asking me to convince my people to risk all in a battle they almost certainly will not see as their fight, to save an enemy who may very well turn around and attack them again. Unlike you, I am not the sole leader of my people, and I do not believe, however convinced I may be, that I can persuade them to such a course. Akella sat quietly, her face impassive. Then she opened her mouth, but the words she'd intended never came out. The comm unit on the table buzzed. She nodded to Baron, and she tapped the unit. I requested that I not be disturbed, Kelleran. Many pardons, Number One, but Megaron Ilias has returned. The verification force has engaged the enemy, and they were successful. They were able to score multiple hits on the other ships. The Avia plan works, Number One. Akella remained remarkably unemotional, considering the import of what she just heard. Call the Council to Assembly, Kelleran, by my command, in 1 hour. She tapped the comm, closing the line. She sat for a moment, silent. Then she stood up. I must go, Tyler. I must address the council. I understand. I can wait for you here. No. Baron turned, startled. You will accompany me, if you are willing. I must convince you I am trustworthy, and keeping you from my peers, from the council and the rest of the High Command will not achieve that goal. I ask only that you keep in mind that we, too, have difficulties among each other, even as I perceive considerable friction between you and your Senate. Many on the council are recklessly proud. Many have lost their way. But by showing you all of this, I hope to convince you that I, at least, am true to my ideals and to my word. Baron nodded, all he could manage at first through the surprise that hit him. He'd wanted to hate Akella when he'd first arrived, but now he found that impossible. She was admirable, almost familiar, and he knew she would have fit in well with a group of his closest comrades. And yet she was my enemy. Chapter 19. Confederation Intelligence Safe House. Liberté City. Petruska Ghetto. Planet Montmorail, Gersara 4. Uninir 225, 321 AC.
How do you think I can possibly kill Villeneuve?
Sandrine Ciara was still stunned at the words that had come from Karevsky's mouth. They'd been discussing the subject for weeks now, and the shock was still as potent as it had been the first time.
How could I even get near him? And if I was able to get close enough to make an attempt, how could I get away?
She paused.
Or I guess my getting away is not a crucial element of the plan. Ridding you and the Confederation of Villeneuve would be a substantial service. Even in the desperate power struggle that would almost certainly follow his death, it's hard to imagine anyone worse prevailing and taking control. A major change in policy is unlikely, but even stasis would be a victory of sorts for the Confederation. We both know Villeneuve will renew hostilities as soon as he believes he has a chance at victory.
Another brief silence.
I understand now how you expect me to repay my debt. Certainly it is not unreasonable, not after all you've done for me. I'd be dead, or worse, if you hadn't helped me, and likely face down in the gutter somewhere rather than striking back, taking my enemy with me.
Sandrine, please, you know that is not what I mean. A lie, or at least partly so. He had been conflicted, a war waging in his head between his feelings for Ciara and his duty as a Confederation intelligence operative. He wasn't quite able to acknowledge he was suggesting a tactic that was very likely to send Ciara to her death, but he was sure he couldn't pass up any chance to get rid of Villeneuve. As long as the sociopathic ruler controlled the Union, another war was a virtual certainty. And the universe had become far more complex since the last Confederation-Union conflict. The Confederation could easily find itself facing both a Union and a renewed conflict with a hegemony at the same time. Killing Villeneuve wouldn't guarantee peace, but it would greatly increase the chances, at least for the foreseeable future. The Union dictator had a pathological hatred for the Confederation, blaming it for all his past failures. A sustainable peace between the two powers was impossible unless Villeneuve was
removed from the equation. Concern for CR wasn't the only issue he was struggling with. His motivations were pure enough to safeguard the Confederation, to protect it from future dangers. But he hadn't been sent to Montmorel to orchestrate a coup. He had already greatly exceeded his mandate, so far to no gain. If he could eliminate Villeneuve, he'd have something to show for straying so far from his orders. But could he really justify extending the magnitude of his improvisations to assassination with the argument that he'd failed so far, but another try might ultimately be worthwhile? He knew his concern should have rested exclusively on that last issue, that sacrificing a Union asset to attain a desirable end should not hinder his choices. But could he really send his lover to her doom? Ciara had been a tool, and nothing more. At least Kurevsky knew that was what she should have been. He could hear Gary Holston's words echoing in his head, shouting at him to keep all relationships with assets cold, impersonal. He'd failed in that, though part of him was still arguing that Ciara was nothing more than a tool, that the feelings he developed for her were simply facets of his deep cover and tradecraft. The question remained, could he pull himself back, act with cold-blooded rationality? Or would he fail in his duty once again, and tie himself to someone who'd become in every way and form, save her possible utility in an assassination plan, a liability?
You wish to seize power, did you not? Your coup may have failed, but with Villeneuve out of the picture, you may yet have an opportunity to salvage parts of your plan.
He didn't really believe she would escape even a successful assassination attempt, but it was all he had, and he was trying to convince himself as much as her.
We both know that will not happen, Alexander, my lover. We are realists, you and I, both veterans in our field of endeavor. Ask me to die for you, to repay you for saving me in the aftermath of the coup. But don't lie to me. Don't ask me to believe that I will survive the plan you are proposing. I will be fortunate enough to reach Villeneuve, to get a significant chance of killing him. But I know well, as I suspect you do, the realities of this plan. The First Citizen has always been quite adept at cultivating loyalty, or an effective facsimile, among his guards. To survive, I would not only have to get in unnoticed, I would have to get back out before anyone discovered the body. That is possible, perhaps, but far from likely.
She paused, Kurevsky standing silently, still wrestling with his thoughts. Duty would win the fight for his soul, he knew, but he would never forgive himself for sending Ciara to her death.
I will do as you ask, Alexander. Not because I believe I can survive the attempt, or even succeed for that matter, and not because I owe you for saving my life.
She took a step toward him and extended her arm, her hand touching his cheek softly.
I will do it for you if you ask me to. But you have to ask.
Kurevsky felt an instant of satisfaction at the thought of removing Gaston Villeneuve from the equation. But the feel of Ciara's soft hand on his face shook his resolve. He tried again to convince himself he wasn't sending her to her death, with no more success than he'd achieved moments before. He looked at her, his eyes meeting hers. She was right in front of him, so close he could hear her breath. She was a killer, he knew, cold-blooded, with a trail of victims behind her he didn't dare to imagine. She was Sector 9, and for all of his professional life she had been an enemy. She deserved death, he suspected, as much as anyone did, and he imagined a whole crowd of ghostly faces, clamoring for him to send her to her well-deserved end. But even as he began to speak the words, the pain hit him. She was what she was, and he didn't lie to himself, tried to mold his knowledge of her into some kind of palatable lie. Deserving or not, evil or not, he had feelings for her, and he had to ignore them. He had to let her go. No, he had to send her, however much it hurt.
I'm asking you, Sandrine, please work with me on this. Please try to kill Gaston Villeneuve.
We have searched the Confederation vessel again, First Citizen. The crew gave us unrestricted access. There's no way, Minister, that the fugitive Ciara is on that vessel.
The officer seemed a bit nervous, at least as much as Foudray Rouge ever got. Gaston Villeneuve had always been an unnerving presence, but since the coup attempt, he'd been a force of nature. He'd ordered thousands of executions, anyone involved in the coup attempt and those he imagined to be part of the Cabal too. No small number of innocents had met their ends in the weeks in Sandrine Ciara's attempt to seize power, friends of those involved, families, household staff. And there were no signs the killings were going to stop anytime soon. Not while Ciara herself remained at large.
I am revoking the Confederation Embassy's credentials, effective 1 week from today.
You will lead a detachment there to inform Ambassador Karevsky personally that he is to be prepared to board his ship and leave Montmirail at that time. You will be escorted to Zabota by a naval squadron.
Yes, First Citizen.
The Foudre Rouge major snapped off a perfect salute, and then he spun around on his heels and marched out of the room. Villeneuve let out a long sigh. He'd been operating on pure rage for the past month or more, and even for a man like him, such fury wore hard on one's psyche. He'd become obsessed with finding Ciara and convinced the only way she could have eluded his trackers for so long was with Confederation help. He was no fool, whether she'd tried to treat him as one or not. He developed a good sense of the resources deployed in the failed coup attempt, and it seemed unlikely she'd been able to assemble that level of funding herself. Where money was involved, he always thought of the Confederation, and the recollections of that enemy's vast wealth, and the ways that it allowed them to best him so often, ratcheted the level of his anger ever higher. He'd had the embassy monitored around the clock, both from outside and using the surveillance assets still hidden in the structure itself. The orbital platforms had scanned Ambassador Karevsky's ship without pause, and no shuttle had docked without first being thoroughly searched, officially for the purpose of ensuring the safety of Confederation personnel from renegade rebels who might do them harm. But all his efforts had come up blank. He'd even resorted to widespread searches, sending the Foudre Rouge out to break down doors throughout the city. His efforts had resulted in the capture of a few minor participants, but no sign at all of Sandrine Ciara. Even the captured plotters had failed to provide useful intelligence, despite enthusiastic interrogations. There'd been a few vague mentions of Confederation involvement, but nothing sufficient to justify sending troops into the embassy, or turning the ambassador and his staff over to Sector 9's inquisitors. He would have done it anyway without justification, but with the apparent hegemony withdrawal from the Rim, he simply couldn't risk war with the Confederation. His forces weren't ready. Not yet, at least.
One day, I need a few more years, perhaps five, or a renewal of the war between the Confeds and the hegemony. But the Union will have its revenge, and those rich and fat worlds of the Confederation will know obedience.
He looked down at the screen, at the document he'd just given the Major to deliver. He might not be able to capture and interrogate the Confederation ambassador, but sending him and all of his staff off-world would leave Ciara on her own. She'd evaded him, remained at large for far too long.
Let's see how well you can hide without your allies, Sandrine.
And when he finally found her, he would not only end the threat she represented with grim finality. Before he did, he would enjoy watching her broken, reduced to a whimpering wreck, sobbing and begging for death. Chapter 20. Planet Calphuron, Sigma Nordlin 4, Year of Renewal 267, 322 AC.
Admiral Baron is here at my invitation. He is to be treated with all appropriate respect, and council debate is to proceed unimpeded while he is here.
Akella spoke in a harsher tone than she'd shown in her talks with Baron, and he realized almost immediately that some of the men and women in the room were political rivals. That didn't make sense to him at first. Akella's genetic rating assured her the top seat, save only for certain extreme circumstances. But he quickly began to understand. Even in the Senate, power struggles raged over leadership positions and control over voting blocks. A speaker only truly possessed authority if he controlled enough votes to pass the measures he desired. As much as Baron had come to see Akella as the leader of the hegemony, he realized that was a gross oversimplification. She had considerable power, certainly, but she wasn't a dictator. Her control was far from absolute, and while she couldn't be removed from her seat absent proof of insanity or some other significant impairment, she could be outvoted, even reduced to figurehead status. And Tyler Baron had seen enough of the Senate's fouler workings to realize that a removal for cause wouldn't require actual mental illness or any of the other specified situations, just enough votes aligned against her.
Number one, with all due respect to our esteemed visitor, the council is in session to review highly sensitive information from the battle lines. I am sure Admiral Baron would understand if we requested he leave this proceeding at some point. Of course, we'll provide a reviewed and redacted transcript. No.
Akella's voice was cold, an anger there Baron hadn't heard before. He knew at once there was bad blood between Akella and the man who'd just spoken. Thantor, Baron reminded himself. And Thantor is number two, her immediate successor. Baron felt almost as though he was in the Senate on Megara.
For all he'd hated the hegemony as invaders and killers of so many of his comrades, he'd somehow imagined they were less beset by political bickering than the Confederation. Now he wasn't so sure.
Akella, be reasonable. The information...
Admiral Baron will not be asked to leave, and if this council insists that he is, I will exercise my power to dissolve this meeting, and I will review the data from the verification force myself.
You cannot do...
I can and I will. Surely you are familiar with the powers granted to the number one of the council. It is my place to preside over each meeting and to determine the agenda. Admiral Baron has come a very long distance, in the aftermath of a bitter war between our nations. He is here to review the situation with the others and to decide whether to recommend to his government that they come to our aid. He must have all information we can provide to make his determination, and we must also earn his trust if we expect help from the Rim. Holding back information, excluding him from discussions about the situation, are inherently destructive to those aims.
Baron could hear a murmur moving around the table, and he could almost feel the shock at what Akella had said. There was arrogance on the Hegemony's council, he realized without doubt, as much as he'd seen in the Senate's deliberations, more even, since the Hegemony was unmistakably the most powerful nation known, save perhaps for the others.
Enough nonsense. If no one has anything to add, perhaps we can begin.
Akella's every word radiated a challenge. No, something more. A dare. No one responded.
Very well. Megaron Ilias has come directly from the shuttle bay to address the council.
She turned toward the door where an officer stood wearing a dress uniform.
Megaron, the floor is yours.
Ilias stepped toward the center of the room. He turned and looked down a large table where the highest-rated masters and the hegemony were seated. He was respectful, at least superficially, but Baron could sense the military commander harbored some resentments toward members of the council. Baron knew little about the inner workings of the hegemony, but he guessed that Ilias was firmly in the Akella Kronos camp. Beyond the specifics of the political dynamics he was watching, he felt a strange sort of relief at seeing the hegemony subject to many of the same problems that plagued the Confederation. For years, even as his hatred for the enemy grew, there had always been a kind of respect, almost an awe that a culture could move past the petty workings of politics and ascend to a higher level. Now he realized if such a civilization could exist, it was not the hegemony, nor the revered old empire, which itself was torn apart by internecine conflict. Perhaps that is mankind's curse, one we will never escape. Masters of the Council, it is an honor to once again stand before you. This time, amid the crisis we face and the shadow cast across our future, the news I bring is fractionally less dark and ominous than that we have endured in recent months. The vessels of the Verification Force, led by Commander Krellos, were able to categorically confirm the theory put forth by Commander Tragus of Avia. The others' vessels do indeed emit detectable levels of Sigma-9 radiation, and Tragus's makeshift scanning routines allow effective firelocks on the enemy vessels. Hit rates in the encounter were considerably below levels we would consider normal battle standards, but we were able to verify a sufficient number of successful shots to conclude without reasonable doubt that the targeting program was effective. A short pause. Further, we have scanner documentation of at least one enemy vessel exhibiting signs of significant damage, including secondary explosions and expulsion of internal materials through one or more hull breaches. Akella had been watching her colleagues on the council, but now she turned toward Ilias.
Thank you, Commander, both for your very welcome report and for the great risk and effort you undertook to bring us this data.
Ilias nodded. Thank you, Number One. Your words are a welcome addition to duty, which, of course, was all that was required. Ilias was silent for a moment. With your indulgence, I would add that the entire verification force was lost, including Commander Krellos. We all know the Commander's illustrious record, and though he is assured a place in hegemony history, I would ask that this council formally recognize his last efforts for the hegemony, as well as the ultimate sacrifice he and his spacers made to aid us all in the fight we now face.
Akella stood up. You are quite correct, Ilias. Commander Krellos deserves nothing less than the greatest honors this council can bestow. I urge my colleagues to stand with me in silent tribute, and then to vote as I do, to proclaim Master Krellos a hero of the hegemony and order that his likeness be carved into the Hall of Masters.
Ilias nodded, a silent acknowledgement, Baron guessed. He was a master and a protege of Kronos, but his genetic ranking did not afford him a place on the council, or a vote on Akella's motion.
I stand with Akella. Krellos was a true hero, a master of the hegemony in every respect and one deserving of all the honor we can provide.
Dantor stood straight and erect, a little too much, Baron thought. He'd seen his share of insincere politicians, and they always overdid it. He also recognized that Akella had backed her rivals into a corner. She had sent Krellos, authorized the mission, and emphasizing its importance, and honoring those who had died carrying it out, could only strengthen her position. Her political adversaries could hardly make a stand refusing to honor an old man who'd performed one last desperate mission for the hegemony and died in the process. He was even more impressed with Akella as he watched her. She seemed so normal when he'd spoken with her, like a real person and not the swamp creature he'd come to see in most politicians. But she could clearly play the political game as well and with a considerable level of skill. He watched as the other council member spoke, each seeking to get on the record with some type of tribute to Krellos. For a few seconds, he almost imagined he was back home on Megara, listening to the Senate prattle on about one pointless thing or another. Finally, the showmanship, and the justifiable recognition of sacrifice, was over, and Akella spoke again. "We have extensive footage from the scanner reports of the exchange with the enemy. While much of the raw data is still being reviewed and analyzed, Commander Ilias has prepared a short sampling for us to see now. If you will all focus your attention on the large screen." She turned and gestured toward a Kriegeri standing next to the room's main door. "Hectoron, dim the lights, please, and activate the display." The room darkened and the screen lit up, a blanket of dark space, and in the background, a sprinkling of stars. In the center of the screen, Baron saw something. A ship, he thought. But like no vessel he'd ever seen. It was there, at least it seemed to be most of the time he stared at it. But there was something strange as well, an eerie sensation. He couldn't quite lock his eyes on the ship. It didn't seem to be moving, not exactly, but it didn't appear to remain in the same place either. Then the image of the ship disappeared as the data shifted to a normal tactical scan. The ship was replaced by a standard scanner contact icon. The small oval lacked the strangeness the direct view of the vessel had exhibited, but it still wobbled strangely on the display, as the recording scanner clearly struggled to maintain contact. Baron began to understand why the hegemony ships had so much trouble targeting their enemies. He couldn't explain what he was seeing, but it didn't take much to extrapolate the difficulties in establishing firelocks on ships whose locations you couldn't precisely pinpoint. He sat quietly, watching as the battle unfolded. The mysterious ships, Baron still hadn't become accustomed to calling them the others, opened fire at a range that seemed almost impossible, especially for what appeared to be energy weapons of some kind. Baron had struggled to deal with the hegemony railguns, and the Confederation had only recently partially closed that gap with its modified primaries. Even those great weapons, the pinnacle of Confederation science, had a range almost 30,000 kilometers less than the hegemony railguns. And the ships on the display were firing at ranges close to 150,000 kilometers greater than even the heaviest railguns. Baron had moved past his unilateral disbelief in the others, to a sort of acceptance that the hegemony did, in fact, have another enemy. But he'd still been struggling to accept the premise that the hegemony's adversary was a threat to the Rim. He'd even wondered if he should try somehow, and he had no idea how, to contact the others. The hegemony had invaded Rim space, killed Rim spacers, and the old adage floated around the edge of his mind. "The enemy of my enemy is my friend." Baron was too cynical to believe some strange force from coreward of the hegemony was a likely ally, but it still nagged at him. He had only Carmisha's impassioned pleas and Akella's assurances that the others were indeed a deadly danger to the Rim as well as the hegemony. Such claims were enormously self-serving for the parties involved, which didn't mean they weren't true. It didn't mean they were, either. As he watched the drama unfold on the screen, however, Baron began to believe what he'd been told. The images were no proof, of course, at least not of the others' intentions with regard to the Rim. But what he was watching was so different, so alien to all he'd seen before, he couldn't help but feel more closely aligned with the hegemony. At least with the version of that polity represented by Akella's words and actions. "Don't forget, she authorized the invasion of the Rim. She may seem reasonable, even wise, but she is a believer in the hegemony's destiny to rule all humanity. Or at least she was." The images on the screen told a story, of hope or of despair, depending on one's analysis. The verification force was scoring hits, proving the hegemony had indeed discovered a way to track and target the enemy. But the hit rates were still abysmal, and for the 40 or more vessels he knew were doomed as he watched, not one of the other ships had been destroyed. And only one had been damaged in any detectable way. That was undeniably an improvement over facing untrackable ships that couldn't be hit, but it was far from something offering the makings of victory. Tyler Barron had spent much of his adult life at war, and what time he hadn't been fighting had largely been spent preparing for the next struggle. His mind moved into action, adding up the numbers, applying them to a full-scale fleet battle. A hegemony force might inflict some damage on the enemy, assuming Akella's people were able to refit all the scanner suites in their massive fleet before the next battle. They might even destroy a number of enemy ships. But there was no way they would win. No way they could win. Not without a vast increase in targeting effectiveness. Or massive reinforcements. Even as the playback continued, Baron's mind raced. He'd been suspicious of the hegemony when he'd arrived, untrusting of the enemy his people had fought for 6 long years. He was still suspicious of them. But the threat he was watching, the almost effortless brutality of the enemy gunning down hegemony ships, vessels his spacers had fought, bled, and died to match. He didn't doubt the others existed. Not anymore. A passing suspicion or two drifted by, imaginings that all he'd seen, all he was watching just then had been staged to trick him. But he realized he was convinced. The hegemony faced a dangerous and deadly enemy, one that quite possibly, if not probably, would destroy it. Baron had imagined the hegemony's defeat 1,000 times, and in every instance he'd felt nothing but satisfaction, grim joy at the fall of an enemy. Now that was all gone, replaced only by fear, by the realization that a power so great as that he was seeing would very likely move onto the rim, assert its dominance there as surely as it seemed intent on doing in the coreward space of the hegemony. He couldn't allow that. After 2 wars, millions dead, the ghostly faces of lost comrades cried out to him to do something, to hold back the darkness, to preserve the Confederation and its Palatian allies. To ensure that all the sacrifice and loss had not been for nothing. Baron was convinced. He knew what he had to do. He just didn't know how to do it. He was forbidden to intervene without senatorial permission, and even if he could convince that body to send the Confederation's fleet so far from home to fight alongside an enemy, former enemy, he was far from sure it would make a difference. Or that their consent and reinforcements would come in time. He sat silently, his thoughts straying from the scene unfolding on the display, one side of his mind arguing with the other. For all the respect he'd gained for Akella, he'd have had no difficulty refusing her request, boarding his shuttle back toward Dauntless and heading home, leaving the hegemony to face their struggle alone. If he hadn't believed the enemy would turn its sights next on the rim, on his own people. He was still wrestling with his thoughts, the debate raging in his head, even as the scanner footage continued on the display. But in the deepest parts of his mind, he knew he'd reached a decision. The others were a threat, not only to the hegemony, but to the rim as well. More than a threat. They were death itself, at least to men and women like him and his spacers, and any others who wouldn't kneel down and surrender, beg to live their lives as slaves. He would send word back to the Senate, his recommendation that the fleet fully mobilize and set out for hegemony space at once. He would also send messages to those he trusted vastly more than the Confederation's governing body, to Clint Winters, Gary Holston, and Vian Tullis. And to Andy as well, of course. He felt a wave of sadness and a touch of guilt. He missed his wife terribly, the pain digging into him like an open wound. But he had the solace, if that was the right word, of being focused on the danger and the looming struggle. Andy was back home with nothing to do but wait for him to return. He felt relief that she was on Megara, safe for once, but that only inflamed the guilt. He'd considered giving her a softer version of the information he was sending the others to ease her worry about him. But he discounted that immediately. She would soon discover the truth, and his foolish attempt to protect her would only end up hurting her. He'd sincerely intended to return home after he'd met with the hegemony officials, reviewing the data they had on the enemy. But the situation was too dire. The threat to the rim, and by extension to Andy herself, was far too imminent. He had to remain, at least for the time being, and if the Senate heeded his advice, most likely with an assist from Gary Holston's machinations, he had no idea when he'd ever return home. If he'd return. He slammed a wall down in his mind, trying to ignore the pain, the cold fear that he might never see Andy again. He struggled with the effort, more than he had in the past. He'd been devoted to his duty with a single-minded focus his entire life. He'd been born into his role, and he'd never had a choice, not a real one. His career had been fulfilling, if also painful, and he looked back on it with pride. But the sacrifices had been great. Would Andy join that list? Would he fight and die far from home without ever seeing her again, holding her in his arms? His expression hardened, his will exerting itself. He would do what he had to do, as he'd always done. But first he had to speak to Akella, alone. He would do as she wanted, urge his people to come to the hegemony's aid, but he had his own demands. Total transparency, complete sharing of information. First, he wanted the scanning data the hegemony had used to target the enemy ships. All of it. Every detail. And second, he wanted a technology team dispatched at once, back to Confederation space to aid Anya Fritz and her people in uncovering all of Colossus's secrets. If Akella wanted the Rim to join the hegemony's fight, she would have to do what he asked, beginning with trusting him as she wanted him to trust her. Chapter 21. Highborn Flagship, Sargavon. Imperial System GH927C1. Year of the Firstborn 384. 322 AC. The figure stepped onto the deck of the control room, tall, dark, casting a shadow that seemed more a manifestation of pure darkness than simply his massive form blocking one of the main illumination fixtures. Grand Admiral Tesrax was dressed all in red, a massive scarlet cape draped behind the darker red, almost black, of the robes he wore beneath. He was tall, 2.5 meters and broad, and his massive body appeared even larger for the implants, the bits and pieces of metal and machinery protruding from areas of his body. The other forms in the control room, all save two who were as tall and imposing as Tesrax himself, leapt up from their seats, snapping to attention with an urgency that belied respect. And even more intensely, fear. Then they all dropped down to one knee, heads bowed. As one, the bridge crew spoke, almost hypnotically.
All hail the mighty Tesserax!
They remained in place for perhaps 10 seconds, until the newly arrived figure waved his hand, a signal that they could rise. Again, almost in unison, they leapt up to attention and returned to their stations. Tesserax walked across the deck, his heavy alloy boots clanging loudly on the polished surface. He stopped in front of a massive seat, surrounded on the floor and above on the ceiling by constructs that appeared to be retracted at present. He sat, and he stared forward for a moment, totally still while the mechanisms of the chair activated. He could feel the small probe extending from behind his neck, slapping into the socket implant. An instant later, he felt a flow of information, the vast AI that powered vessel Sargavon pouring data through the now connected circuit and into the thinking machine implanted in his neck and connected to his cortex. His personal AI interpreted and organized the data it received, feeding it into the biological sections of his greater brain complex at a manageable rate. The speed of thought and data analysis was far faster than any purely biological entity could match. Even the Highborn required implants to meet that maximum potential. He considered the data on the system the fleet had just entered. There was one inhabited planet, notwithstanding smaller groupings of humans on research stations and mining outposts on three of the other worlds and moons. The populated world was Old Imperial, now possessed by those calling themselves the Hegemony. Tesseract's data suggested the leaders of that polity practiced a policy of genetic segregation, the highest among them called Masters. It was amusing, at least to the extent that Tesserax allowed himself time or thought for such superficialities as humor, to imagine such